Bienvenidos and welcome to episode 17 of the Jacobin Sports Show. I am Matthew Miranda, joined as always by the post-lapsarium Jonah Birch.
Hey.
You can follow the show at Jacobin Sports on Twitter, and always email us at jacobinsports@gmail.com. Jonah, there's a lot to get to today, but since it's an NBA day, I'm going to open with a trivia question for you.
Nice.
Can you name the NBA's all-time points leader among players who have spent time with the Boston Celtics and the New York Knicks?
Wow. Okay.
And I will have you know that my initial guess of Walter McCarty was not correct.
Hey.
Just so you know.
So I take it Chris Mills isn't the right answer, is it?
Chris Mills is not it either. Good guess. Very good guess. It is not Xavier McDaniel.
Another good one. Okay, I'm stumped.
So I didn't even know this guy played for the Celtics. Bob McAdoo
right.
played 20 games with the Celtics in 1979.
Yep.
And I just want to point out, I did not know this. This is the rare instance of the Knicks just fleecing the Celtics in a trade. The Knicks sent McAdoo to the Celtics for 20 games. They got back 3 first-round picks, one of which they used on Bill Cartwright, and another one they used on Sly Williams, who, along with Slick Watts, shares the greatest name in NBA history. So just so you know,
what a disaster. Red Auerbach just getting destroyed in a trade like that.
He got Larry Bird right after, so he turned out okay. But I had no idea Bob McAdoo was a Celtic. That was very much news to me.
Very, very brief and I think kind of a forgettable stint. And then he ended up on the Lakers, right? So he was playing on the Lakers in the early 80s.
He did. Better times for Mr. McAdoo.
Was.
There is joy and pain today also in the world of sports. We want to congratulate, of course, Manchester City, Jonah, clinching their 5th top-flight English championship when Leicester beat Man United 2-1. So congratulations to Man City and Pep Guardiola and their incredible team and their incredible, beautiful fans.
Can I just say, what a brutal 24 hours for me. You know, the Jaylen Brown, who we're going to talk about, I mean, it kept me up all night thinking about Jaylen Brown. It's just so awful. And then today, Manchester United plays the backup, the B lineup, because they're playing Liverpool on Thursday and end up losing to Leicester, just killing my Liverpool team on both ends. Mm-hmm. It's been a tough Tuesday in the world of sports.
Has been. Also, sad news out of California, where Colt Brennan today passed away. Colt Brennan was only 37. He set numerous records at the University of Hawaii as a quarterback, including the single season touchdown record, which was just recently broken by Joe Burrow. Brennan suffered about 10 years ago a traumatic brain injury in a car accident that derailed his pro football career and has passed away entirely too soon. I hope that he is at peace and we wish love and light to his family, because that's very sad news. Very unexpected news today. So now we'll move into the world of purely 100% unadulterated NBA content. And we will introduce today's guest. Our guest, we're very pleased to have him on today. He is a senior writer at Sports Illustrated. He has previously written for 538, ESPN, and The Wall Street Journal, making him the first in what we must assume will be a long-running intersection of Jacobin Sports and former Rupert Murdoch employees. He was also a former beat writer for the New York Knicks, who has a book coming out called Blood on the Hardwood, The Flagrant History of the 1990s Knicks. We are very pleased to have on the show today NBA writer royalty Chris Herring. Chris, how are you doing? Welcome to the show.
I'm good. Thank you for that introduction. I appreciate it. It's good to be with you guys.
Yeah, it's very good to have you here. As Jonah alluded to, let's go to the recent bad news first, which is Jaylen Brown's wrist injury. Sadly, even people who don't like the Celtics, Jaylen Brown is just so easy to root for as a player and a person. Unfortunately, he is out for the year. Chris, it's been some year for the Celtics with injuries and COVID and just struggles. Does Brown's injury to you give them kind of a mulligan on just like, all right, this is just not your year and there's been a lot of irregularity and now just come back strong next year and give it a run again? Or do you feel that this could somehow up the pressure on Boston to realize like we're running out of time and we need to make a move of some sort soon?
Well, first of all, to the first part of the question, yeah, I mean, this is not their year. There were always those flashes in those moments where you have Jason Tatum going off for 60, and stuff like that. that make you think, you know, this is still going to be a really tough team to just kind of extinguish and take out in the playoffs. And who knows, that, you know, Tatum always has that sort of capability to do something like that. But you would much prefer it not be all on his shoulders. He's still a young guy. And I think he's as good a reminder as anybody in the league right now when we talk about the virus and still not really knowing its effects, the idea that he has to take an inhaler before games. So all those things, and you add in Kemba's health issues and his struggles, and very much a feeling of this not being the year. As far as ramping up the pressure, I think the biggest question that you've got going forward now is the idea that when you got Kemba on board, you probably figured and hoped that he'd be more productive than he's been. And if he's not going to be, and if he's kind of just at the level that he's at now, slightly better, slightly worse, it means you're going to need more out of Tatum. You're going to need more out of Brown. And quite frankly, you probably need more out of other guys, or that you need to go out and get somebody. And, you know, I can't remember who said it, if it was a podcast I was listening to recently or if it was something on ESPN. Someone said, I mean, it makes sense when you think about it. They've been losing guys for a couple of years. Obviously, you have Kemba, but Kyrie was an outgoing guy. You obviously had Gordon Hayward, who, you know, is everyone's favorite person to complain about when he's on your team, or at least when he was there. But then when he's not there, I mean, the guy's having a great season before he got hurt in Charlotte. So, I mean, it seems marginal until it's not there anymore. And it reminds me a little bit. If you've heard me on other podcasts, you know I always compare everything to when I covered the Knicks. When I did, you know, I remember the first story I wrote and how controversial it was when I was on the beat, where it was Carmelo, Amari, and Tyson. And I wrote a story about how they were the oldest team in NBA history because it was the year they signed Marcus Camby and Jason Kidd, Pablo Prigioni, Rasheed Wallace, Kurt Thomas. They signed 35-year-olds in one single offseason, the same offseason they lost Jeremy Lin. And I wrote about how concerning that was. And people were like, why do you care about that? They're not an old team. Carmelo and Amari and Tyson are young. But those are the guys that back up those three. And if all of a sudden those guys are hurt and your main three guys have to play longer minutes, they're more likely to get hurt because of it. So there's all sorts of different things that go into it. And depth is wildly important, particularly when you've got like borderline all-star sort of, you know, talent that is your serving as a backup. It can present other problems too about role and everything, but once you get those ironed out, when those guys aren't there anymore, it's painful. And I think Boston is kind of seeing some of that this year. It's been nice to see guys like Nesmith and other guys step up a little bit, but it's asking a lot for them to do that in a playoff series. And I don't, you know, I just frankly don't think there's quite enough to really make much of a run without Jaylen Brown. I think most people probably recognize that.
Jonah, what do you think your team's ceiling is now with Brown out?
Oh, gosh. I mean, you know, the play-in tournament will be fun, even if they end up losing to the Wizards. You know, Jaylen had so much on his shoulders earlier this season. And the last couple of weeks, you could see he wasn't right. And, you know, they were saying that he was going to come back, but definitely, you know, there was so much on him. It makes sense that he's had a bit of a breakdown. It's complicated what you're saying about the Celtics team, because in some ways they have pieces. I mean, Fournier has looked good the last few games. Nesmith came out of nowhere. We talked about it last week. Pritchard is, I mean, that's a piece that they didn't have last season. Rob Williams has shown flashes. And if you remember back to the bubble, I mean, Gordon Hayward was out for pretty much the entire playoffs. Kemba was pretty hobbled. He's actually been a little bit better, at least, you know, in some stretches he's been better. The biggest thing for me for this team is, with all of the injuries, with all of the problems this year, they just look like a mess at times on the court. And I'm not saying that's Brad Stevens' fault, but it is the reality with all the pieces coming in and out. They gave up 79 points in the first half to the Heat. That's something that you just do not expect with a Brad Stevens team. The issue there was not about offensive firepower. They look completely disorganized. That's something they're clearly not going to be able to fix, you know, before the playoffs. Now, the question for me, looking ahead, and this may be a bit beyond what we're talking about here, but if they can re-sign Fournier for next season, could they put something together that could be more legit, right? That could really compete in the East. And I do think that there's talent there.
Yeah, I think there is too. And I think it'll be interesting to see. Their offseason to me is one of the more interesting ones in the league because it's they have some really intriguing young players, but they're kind of, to me, kind of a top-heavy roster in the sense that I don't think they want to trade Tatum or Brown. And once you get past those two, I don't know how much is there that would make for a real significant move to other teams. But Danny Ainge is very active, and Stevens is a great coach, and the Celtics don't tend to just stand pat and let things happen. So it'll be an interesting offseason, but what a bizarre year just from the start to the end for that team.
Let me ask you guys this question, and I feel like this is blasphemous even to ask, but Marcus Smart, who has had such a tough season, you know, and there are people in the Boston media, which is ridiculous and almost always wrong, that have been trying to ride him out of town for forever, and I hate mm-hmm. that, and I am 100% against that. But in terms of salaries that could match up, you know, with another piece and places that there could be some strength on the team already and, you know, where you want to fill weaknesses, is there a trade market for Marcus Smart? He's had a really bad season.
Chris, you would know better than I.
I think there absolutely is. I just wonder, like, man, and it's so funny because I think every fan base and every team has a tendency to kind of overvalue their own talent. But you let go of that guy, man, when you talk about like heart and soul, I don't know that there are many more people that I think of above him, certainly. And when you think about saving guys' bodies, I mean, he gives up his to, you know, to save other guys. Brown and Tatum are the first two people I think about that don't have to do a lot of the dirty work that he does, that all of a sudden, if you're trying to preserve those guys, one guy coming off the virus, and, you know, granted, this is a wrist thing for him, you know, for Jalen. So that's a tough one, especially when his game has progressed. You know, it's not that he's developed into this offensive superstar, but he's become a better three-point shooter than I think we imagined he would, even if he has regressions at times.
And a good passer,
Yeah, that would be a really tough. Could you do it, and would someone take? Absolutely, because he's someone that you could build an entire culture around. But I would really kind of have to swallow hard before I'd make a trade like that.
Okay, forget I asked that. I don't want to do it. I take it all back. We're keeping Marcus Smart.
Chris, you're uniquely qualified to address this. I have for years maintained to other Knicks writers and fans that I know that if Marcus Smart had been on the 94 Knicks on the bench, that team would have won the title. Because by the time they got to the playoffs, particularly the backcourt, particularly in the finals, was so... Riley had faith in nobody. They were very depleted. And there's not a lot of guys today that you can say they would fit. Like, you could throw them back into 1994 and they would be okay. And I think of Smart now as kind of the super version of what they might have hoped they were getting from Greg Anthony, which was like this great defensive guard who has the ability. Smart is the kind of guy to me that, like, for 3.5 quarters, if he wants to shoot a three, I'm fine playing against him. But in the last few minutes, if he wants to shoot a three, I'm terrified. Because he just seems to be more of that kind of a shooter. Chris Herring, you may have never been asked this question before. If Marcus Smart were on the 94 Knicks, does Patrick Ewing have a statue outside 33rd and 8th today?
If he's in the rotation, probably. Mm-hmm. Yeah, if he's playing every day. And he would have been, because it's funny, like, calling someone a non-shooter in this era is very different than a non-shooter in that era. Man, well, those guys would be Jeff Hornacek in that era. Probably. It's so difficult to not just be able to share everything about the book. I mean, there's some stuff that just even if Riley had done a thing or two different in that game, that they win that game. But yeah, I mean, in some ways he would have fit those teams. I mean, I think he would have... The fan base would have been in love with somebody like him, which is, I'm sure, similar to the way that the Celtics fans feel. So I got a great quote from Selena Roberts for my book, who covered the Knicks in the late 90s and maybe the early 2000s. She said part of the reason that Patrick was like not – because when you think about it, like now I think it's a little bit different, but in the moment, I don't think Patrick Ewing was necessarily everybody's favorite player if you were a Knicks fan. Like Parks probably was. Maybe Oakley, Mason, like people felt really strongly about those three. And some people have put it to me where it's like, you would think that those three were in the rafters right now with their
Yeah.
And Ewing was kind of the guy that, you know, everybody rooted for him because he was the best player. But, you know, whether he was your favorite player was a different story. And Selena Roberts said, well, that's because everybody else was doing something outward where you saw it, where Starks is headbutting people and his face is getting red. And he's, you know, he's dunking and he's, you know, you could, I think Mike Breen said you could see his heart beating through his jersey. And Oakley, you know, maybe he's not showing that sort of emotion, but he's knocking people on the floor constantly. Mason, every single thought that's going through his head, you can almost, you almost have passion for him, you feel like. Ewing was different, where everything that he was doing was kind of inward and behind the scenes. He wasn't really opening up to the media much. And so Selena Roberts kind of said that his best attribute was kind of just that he was loyal and just that he, you know, that he was going to work hard, but that's, it's not necessarily something that you see outwardly all the time. Marcus Smart is someone that is very outward, that, that makes you feel something, love him or hate him. If you're an opponent, you probably hate him, but he would have fit in perfectly with those Knicks from that standpoint, where I think fans would have just fallen in love with the guy because of how hard he worked. I don't know how prevalent flopping was in the 90s, to some extent, but it would have been interesting from that standpoint. But he also had the toughness to back it up. So I think fans would have loved him. And I do think maybe adding someone like him to that team, a better shooting version than Greg Anthony, and quite frankly, bigger than Greg Anthony, too. I think he's a little taller, a bit strong, certainly a lot bigger than Greg Anthony was. But yeah, Greg Anthony, and it has a little bit of that hot-headed temper, too. I watched a clip of Greg Anthony a couple months ago. I've made a point of trying to watch as many games from the 90s as I can. And some dude uploaded like almost every damn Knicks game from the 90s YouTube. And I found one of the 90s Knicks playing against Greg Anthony for the first time after they let him walk in the expansion draft. They left him unprotected and he was on the Grizzlies. And he was playing his first game against the Knicks and he was killing them. And the game went down to the final minute. And I think the Grizzlies were down by one or two. And Greg Anthony felt like he got fouled and didn't get the call with like 10 seconds left. They would have been in position to foul and get the ball back. And instead, Greg Anthony like shot up from the floor and like raced over to the ref and like bumped chest with the ref. And it's just like this dude really had a temper, you know, to a point where it obviously cost him, obviously, the Phoenix fight, which later had a big impact on the Knicks. Anyway, I'm going down the rabbit hole. But yeah, I think Marcus Smart would have had a place with those teams.
Speaking of players that we love and hate, and I'm going to get to this person by way of classical music. There was a composer, Schoenberg, who famously came up with this compositional school called 12-tone row, which was, you know how on a piano there's 12 different tones, and in Schoenberg's music, in this 12-tone style, you cannot repeat any note until all of them have been used at least once. So it's very formulaic. It often sounds not pleasant, but it was an idea, it was a theory, and somebody once asked Schoenberg about this, and he said, like, he recognized it wasn't the most aesthetically attractive style, but he felt as a composer, it's my job to try everything so the people who come after me don't have to do it. They're free to do, like, other things. It's an interesting viewpoint. This leads me to Russell Westbrook. Russell Westbrook is a fascinating, to me, amalgamation of things that never add up. And first, Jonah, I want to, before I get into my questions, I know that you just love Russell Westbrook with no restraint, and I want you to take this time to tell the world what it is about Russell Westbrook. Because I just wrote a piece about Westbrook, and I find myself in the same place where I am theoretically in love with what Russell Westbrook brings to the NBA, but when I watch him play, I cannot always say. And it's weird because he plays so hard, like he covers all these things.
He
never leaves anything on the court. He puts up these Ruthian numbers across the board in all our favorite counting categories, but he's still kind of derided as like, he's selfish, he's not efficient, he doesn't. And I want to get into the everything of Westbrook, but first I just want you to take this moment to explain to our listeners why you, Jonah Birch, love Russell Westbrook so much.
Not only does he play hard, but he has this this kind of fuck you attitude, which to be honest, I love. He's won me over. Yeah, he's gotten so much shit from all corners, from teammates, obviously. I mean, at least implicitly, KD leaving was definitely a referendum on Westbrook, and he's had his issues in Houston. And obviously, I mean, some of the media attacks, particularly at the beginning of the season, Stephen A. Smith And I love that he doesn't let it get to him. And he says, screw you, I'm the best player on the court. I mean, I respect that. And to be honest, his ability to keep going, given the way this season was beginning with in Washington and how they've turned it around, how could you not love that, right? I mean, like, I want to live my life that way. That is a model for all of us.
Here's the thing, Chris, and I'll put this question to you. Researching this piece today on Westbrook, I find that he is this year shooting a higher percentage at the rim than he ever has. He's shooting a career best on corner threes. And yet, he's taking fewer shots at the rim than ever. He's having a career worst season at the foul line. All his advanced shooting numbers are down. Nobody plays harder than him, but the effort and the productivity, it can sometimes feel like sound and fury, like signifying nothing. What do you make of Russell Westbrook? Have you ever seen someone like this? What do you make of this player after all these years?
Yeah, I mean, it's really strange because this is now the second or third year in a row where it's been kind of a tale of two seasons for him. He had a pretty bad year in Houston last year, but then for like a 23-25 game stretch was just lights out, averaging 32 and, you know, the near triple-double numbers, but also on crazy efficiency. But the, you know, and Houston kind of built their entire team around trying to help him do that by getting rid of Capella. And that was when he took off to open up the floor a little bit more. So, you know, when you watch him do that, you ask the question, like, why can't he just do this all the time as far as what he's prioritizing? Because where he really falters is kind of obvious. He is not a very good perimeter shooter. And like you said, isn't it just kind of natural if someone is, you know, a career high at the rim to shoot more at the rim, to try to get to the rim more? It takes something out of you to get there, obviously. But like, if the trade-off is you're shooting long range jump shots that aren't going down, and, you know, Russ has been pretty much, if you were to extrapolate it over like a 10-year span, I guarantee you there's no one that's taken more threes that shot like a worse percentage than he has. So it's just weird where it would be like if you took a lighter or something and just kept flicking it like close to your skin, just like almost like not quite to hurt yourself, but almost. And that's kind of how it feels. So it's so hard to make sense of. And you get almost like a lot of this Jekyll and Hyde in the same season where he was brutal. And I mean, this is probably my feeling. I don't think I wrote him off, but like, he looked on that trajectory to where it's like, this is really bad, like career-wise, as far as what it's saying. I wrote a story about Blake Griffin earlier in the season, basically asking, like, are we reaching an age now in the NBA where athleticism alone isn't enough to really get you through once you get past, like, age 29 or 30? Because Blake was, like, all NBA a year and a half ago, and we were watching him look like he was obsolete completely, where he hadn't dunked in a year and a half, and was shooting 34% in Detroit. And obviously Brooklyn is an ideal, you know, panacea sort of situation. But basically I said, you know, if we have those concerns about Blake, Russell Westbrook's on the exact same trajectory as someone that doesn't shoot well, that, you know, that used to get to the rim a lot and now looks like he can't. And I don't know if it was health. I don't know if it was COVID, because he had that last year as well. I don't know if it's the situation he's in. I don't know if it's playing next to another high usage guard. But for whatever reason, like, he turns it off and turns it on, or maybe it's just health or anything else. I was watching NBA TV yesterday, and they're like, I'll tell you what it was. It was that he didn't make the All-Star team, and it was bugging him. I really hope it wasn't that, because Russ strikes me as the kind of guy that works his entire ass off all the time. Mm-hmm. But you do wish sometimes that it would manifest itself in kind of just better decision-making, which, you know, what's the name of that movie? How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb, or whatever.
Doctor Strangelove. Yeah.
Great movie. There's a little bit of that to Russell Westbrook, though, where it's like, that was the approach I took last night when he broke the record. It's just, people like this don't come around. You know, he plays hard. I mean, could he give more effort on defense? Sure. There's no question about that. There's been no question about that. But like, it really is kind of an experience to watch him play. And and I've said that for years. I've felt that for years. He's far from perfect. You know, I think that we've seen kind of, you know, I think Chris Paul's kind of his antithesis, is a guy that also hasn't won the big one,
but, you know, plays, and it's like a very measured sort of style that he plays with. Russell just plays with kind of reckless abandon. Not everybody loves that, but it does suck, because I kind of feel like the pendulum has swung so far in one direction now, at least on Twitter, where I tweeted a congratulations message, not to him, but about him last night. And before the tweet had been up for 3 minutes, people were like, ha ha ha, you would tweet this while they're losing. He's a bum, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, they were down by 18 points 4 minutes ago, and now it's a 1-point game, like, all in the end of Russell kind of leading this comeback. So people are just like, there's just something about him that a lot of people don't like. There's something about him that a lot of people love. He's a very polarizing figure, but we aren't going to see anything like him for a while. And so I'm hoping that people can at least enjoy some of it, if not all of it.
Now, do you guys feel like the triple-double thing has been a real distraction when it comes to everyone's relationship with him? I don't just mean, you know, for him, right? Like the kind of stat padding people talk about, but it's such a polarizing stat, and people's, you know, how you feel about this record, it really dominates debates about Russell, and all the discussion is about the triple double thing. And there's a way in which, I don't know, it's taken away from some of the incredible, I mean, he's done some pretty incredible things in his career beyond just those numbers, right? I mean, he's such an athletic freak, and you know, someone who's been able to put up numbers for a very long time. So I, you know, maybe that's distorted our view of him, our impression, the triple double thing.
I wonder about time and market also, because there's two players that he's not like, but he reminds me of them in certain ways, and they're both guys who went through Philadelphia. He reminds me of Allen Iverson only in the sense that he's never not going to do what he's doing. Like, Iverson maybe could have lengthened his career if he had been willing to take a different role post-Philadelphia, and maybe if he had done some things differently. And he wasn't, like, for better or worse, and that's part of what made him at his best what he was. But, like, Allen Iverson was going to be Allen Iverson all the way. And Russell Westbrook, to me, feels like a guy who was, whether he's playing with Kevin Durant or whether he's playing with Paul George or Harden, or he's always going to be what he is. He also reminds me, and this is odd because there's only like about a 1-inch difference in their height, but we don't think of them as similar players. He reminds me at times of what Charles Barkley was in the 90s, in the sense that you had this physical freak of a player who got a lot of criticism for taking. Charles Barkley was, I'm pretty sure by percentage, like the worst 3-point shooter in history for the number of attempts that he took.
I think he still is.
Is he?
I think so.
Barkley, I remember Marv Albert just always, and John Andres, like, dying when Barkley would shoot threes. And, you know, he's only an inch taller than Westbrook. He was a great rebounder. He did everything. Charles Barkley did everything. But it was a different time and a different standard. And athleticism, I think, meant something different, and efficiency too, than they do now. And so I feel like Westbrook, in a different age, and in some ways, Westbrook is in the worst possible time for him to be appreciated. Like you were saying with Paul, and not only Paul, but also with Steph Curry, like when those are people contrasted to him, all of his flaws come out. But he seems like the kind of player that every fan base would love. Like, he just can't not be what he is, but not always appreciated for it. I want to talk a little bit about the play-in tournament, which I am growing more and more excited about, which that is what has me concerned. I'm loving this tiered effect. I'm loving that it now affects so many teams. So now 5 and 6 don't want to be 7 and 8, and 7 and 8 don't want to be 9 and 10, and they don't want to be 11. I like that. I think it's very exciting. It's starting to remind me a very little bit of the recent European Super League controversy, Chris, in that it seems like the play-in tournament, and maybe I'm wrong on this, was designed to create excitement at the bottom of the conferences, but that nobody anticipated that teams like the Lakers and Celtics and Warriors would be potentially in it. And you're hearing, like LeBron James, for example, Sean Hyken had a tweet from last March where LeBron about the tournament said, quote, you got Portland, you got Memphis, New Orleans and Sacramento tinkering around there. So if there's 5 or 10 games left, why not those guys battle it out? Make them play each other all 5 games. Contrast that to recently when LeBron said, quote, whoever came up with that shit needs to be fired. Perhaps not the King's finest moment on the throne, but it raises an interesting question to me, Chris, which is, you know, 25 years ago, Major League Baseball started interleague play, and it was unbelievably exciting when it started because it had never been done before. And now it's not a blip. You know, the Mariners are playing the Pirates on a Tuesday and nobody cares. Do you feel like the play-in tournament is exciting because it's a novelty and there's just all these things at stake that we haven't seen before? Do you feel like this is something that will stay? Because, you know, the leagues are always having this tension of, like, how do you make the regular season worthwhile, but not to the point that you're diluting the playoffs, but you want it to mean something? How do you feel about how it's shaping up? And have you heard anything about whether the league would consider playing around with the arrangement because of comments from, like, Mark Cuban and Draymond Green and Luka Doncic and LeBron, or they just have to suck it up and this is what it is?
Last week was very interesting because you saw a lot of folks that I respect quite a bit, Jay Adande, you know, obviously some of these players and owners and stuff like that, who were more or less saying, like, if the Lakers suffer here or fall out of this situation, don't get a full round in the playoffs because of this, someone really messed this up, and it's doing the exact opposite of what it should have been doing, which I don't think that's my argument at all. I won't say I don't care. I think I'd prefer to see the Lakers make it than not, just because I think that they have a better chance to win the whole thing than most teams if they're there and they're healthy. I don't care as much about that part of it. But what I will say, I like it. I do think some of it is kind of a novelty effect where we're not used to this, and all of a sudden it's like these teams matter that normally wouldn't. I do think there's something to be said, though, for the fact there was something that I kind of liked about last year with the bubble where you had an opportunity, but you had to be within a certain amount of games to have that opportunity. And I'm not sure what that threshold should be. To me, I mean, honestly, where are the Lakers now? Where they're probably like a solid two or three games in front of whoever's in 10th. So they're not at risk of falling all the way out, not even having a chance to play themselves in. But if they were up by like an extra two or three games, and we're talking about like a five-game gap between them and whoever comes next, I don't think you should have to win a game or two games to get yourself in. And I don't know if the standings would ever be that. I'm not good about math. It's funny. I have a numbers reputation, but not good with math. But I'm not sure if it would even be feasible for there to be that big of a gap between 6, 7, 8, and then like the 9s and the 10s or further down than that. But if they do keep this and going forward, they're going to keep it. I wonder if there's something that they tighten up to make it so that you're not getting a situation where you've got a one-game playoff essentially between two teams that weren't even really that close in terms of their winning record. I don't think 5 games seems like a really, really big gap. I do think this has just been kind of an unusual year where, I mean, quite frankly, I think it just speaks to how absences really hurt even more in a 72-game season, which is why the MVP discussion was kind of weird to me that people were considering Embiid so long into the process. Missing games really hurts when you miss 20 of them in a 72-game season. So LeBron missed 20 in a row. Davis missed, what, 30? And it's okay, it kind of makes sense that they're fighting for their lives to stay in here. It wasn't like that before they got hurt, but it is going to be like that now because it's a short season. So, of course, they don't like it. I don't like the idea of completely altering the rules or saying it's unfair after the fact, which I think you were smart to bring up. It is a good plan just to keep teams engaged. You want anti-tanking and for teams not to tank. Okay, well, here's a way to kind of confirm that teams that are even sniffing the playoff hunt are going to be incentivized to keep winning. So, I mean, it's, you know, you can complain about everything, I guess, but I think it is actually a smart idea. It certainly had my attention toward the end of the season in a way that I normally lose interest by now. And I'll add, too, like, this is one of the few things that the league has going for right now that I think is an added incentive to keep watching, because I wrote a couple weeks ago, the league hasn't seen this many blowout 20-point games in the second half of a season. I think it was the second highest rate of blowouts after the All-Star break. The last time we saw one that it was this high a rate of blowouts was 53 years ago. So, like, there's really – these games are really awful, a lot of them. And, I'm very averse to really spending a whole lot of time talking about ratings. But when we talk about things that hurt the ratings and this and that and injuries and everything else, we also have to talk about just the product has not been very good these last couple months. As far as competitive games, the Knicks are the one exception. All their games are close, seemingly.
Yeah, right.
Just about everything else has been really bad, where you're literally looking up and seeing 60-point deficits sometimes, depending on what night you're watching a game. So this is one way to kind of counteract some of that, to just at least keep you interested. So I think it's done well for them, for the league. I understand that Dallas might not like it, but it's funny because I haven't really heard Dallas complaining about it much since they slid into that number six spot. So that's just the way it works.
Very true.
We were just talking about the Wizards turning around their season. And if the play-in tournament didn't exist, it would be a completely different situation for them, yeah? Mm-hmm. And honestly, anything that puts the Lakers in danger of not making the playoffs, I'm for. I'm 100% for. The only thing is, man, like the players have, given COVID, given the compressed season, what a tough, tough, physically demanding, season this has been. And to add games to it, for some teams, this was a difficult one to start in, I guess is what I would say.
I'm pretty sure I just read that Charlotte, because of like reschedules and cancellations, that the Hornets have a back-to-back-to-back three games in a row late this year, which I can't remember. Though I don't know if I've ever, maybe not since 99, have I seen that?
That's my one concern. I keep saying that without trying to sound dramatic or that I'm like hoping for something to happen. But, I said before, I don't really care whether the Lakers make it. I think they, the whole thing would be more competitive if they're in the playoffs. But that's actually my fear here, is that obviously, I think most of us that appreciate the game would love to see LeBron with the chance to, to keep bolstering his legacy. He's obviously the best player of this generation. My fear is, if the Lakers, let's say that they were somehow 10th or 9th or 10th instead of where they are right now, which is 7th, I would really hate to see the Lakers, particularly Davis, really just gutting it out and then getting hurt, because at a time of year where even if they had 82 games and they would have an extra 10 game cushion, a little bit more time to get some cohesion, and then they're not worried about making it in. Or if it's a normal year where there's no play-in, they're not probably worried about getting an 8 seed, because they could probably beat Utah if they had to, in a normal season. They probably have that sort of confidence at least. But I really just don't want to see someone have like a catastrophic injury playing in a game where they have to go way harder than they normally would if it were a normal 82 game season, or if there weren't a plan. And when I watch LeBron trying to come back from an injury, and then, two games into his return from his last injury, got hurt. We've seen Davis reaching down at his calf every other night. Yep. Granted, maybe the last one was cramps. I'm not sure what it was. I just hope they're healthy. I hope that, seeing Beal get hurt the other day was rough. Obviously Jaylen Brown, we were just talking about, you just hope that, that there's not kind of a cycle of more injuries as we watch. As you've got guys playing really hard competitive basketball in the last week, that's going to happen. That's part of it. But you just hope that there's nothing really, really serious that just makes you say, man, I wish that, there'd been a way around this. Because like you said, it's been a weird season just because of the virus, for sure.
Speaking of LeBron, I want to ask a question about the NBA and and sports betting. So the Knicks are playing the Lakers tonight. The LeBron status keeps changing from what I've seen. First, it was a lot of words, smoke that he was going to play tonight. And then the Lakers, I think, officially listed him as out. And I read, I can't remember who it was now, but someone on Twitter was talking about pressure from the NBA's kind of new sports betting partnership for like clarity and transparency. I don't want to get into speculating at all about LeBron and the game tonight, but what I'm curious about, Chris, is that two things. Question one is the NBA expecting their sports betting revenue, to have like a significant impact on like the salary cap going forward? And is there any concern, I guess it's too late now, but is there any concern about they're having this relationship now with the industry of gambling, given that for most of the 20th century, gambling and sports they tried to keep them apart. And I know it's a different time and everything, but is there any concern at the NBA level that this will backfire, or is the money so big coming in that that'll wash out any of the concerns?
Yeah, I don't know that they have concerns. And I should add too, like, I'm not super well versed on this stuff, although I kind of expect that I'll need to be at some point, just because the marriage and relationship between these leagues and betting, like you said, they were trying to keep it church and state before, and now it's kind of this really awkward, like, quick shotgun wedding, seemingly, you know, as far as I want to say the Knicks and a number of other teams had a number of the sites and the betting sites and stuff like that on the court as logos, you know, on the sideline and stuff like that for FanDuel. So I can say that I'm sure that the league probably really does care about the transparency of injury reports. I think the NFL has always been really, really, really big on that. And was it the last game? I can't remember. There's somebody that played that was went from questionable to out to then they were playing or something like that really recently. I can't remember who it was, but people were like complaining about it from that standpoint. Some fans were happy about it, but then ones that bet were probably really angry about it. So there is some of that that, you know, that does come into play. I could imagine that, particularly now as we're talking about all sorts of stuff riding on the playoffs and the play-in, and if that were to happen in the playoffs or someone all of a sudden becomes available, that there probably is going to be closer monitoring of that stuff. But I'm not sure at all how it factors into the cap. I know that, you know, for the people that have to make long-term projections of how big a part it will be, I'm sure it'll be increasingly bigger. But, I mean, you can't go 2-3 minutes without seeing, you know, stuff that's tied to betting and gambling, you know, whether it's the little mini commercials that they put in the games where guys are shooting free throws and they do like a split screen, or, you know, during the commercial breaks where they go to a legitimate commercial, whether it's the stuff on the court, whether it is, you know, you name it, it's there. I have friends now that I don't even talk to all that much that will send me stuff and, you know, send me screenshots of their live bets that they've got going. I'm like, I don't care about this. I'm not betting. I don't have anything riding on this, but they want me to know that they do. I'm like, okay, great. So, I mean, it's interesting because it's drawing. I don't know how many new people it's drawing, but it's drawing some people that are certainly more interested. That was their playing game. That was a way to keep them more interested and engaged at a time where they wouldn't give a damn. So, I mean, I think the league is cognizant of that. It's kind of taking over very quickly.
As we approach the end of the season, we approach not just the playoffs, but also voting for all the different awards. And I don't know if you could answer this question, but how did the players end up accepting a reality where media votes on things like all NBA teams affect their contract extensions to the point that I think I read Jason Tatum, there could be a $32 million difference in what a max deal is for him based on whether or not he's voted onto one of the All-NBA teams. Like, I'm guessing that's something that was collectively bargained. It doesn't sound to me ever like the players are happy, and maybe that's because the ones who are named and get the bigger money, they have nothing to say because they're happy, and maybe it's just the vocal minority. But it seems very much like a source of contention for the players. I've read a number of media people who don't seem comfortable knowing that their decision makes that kind of an impact.
Part of why I don't vote. It's part of why I don't vote. That's part of it. I mean, I came into the game as a writer at the Wall Street Journal, and my sports editor did not want us involved in voting and told us that we weren't supposed to. So I kind of came in that way, but the thought he had in mind, like it's kind of, in my opinion, kind of bad enough that we're involved anyway for NBA. I don't think it's wrong for media to vote on certain stuff, but like if you want to go one step crazier, I mean, the Hall of Fame is determined that way in the NFL, where you've literally got, in most cases, a journalist, almost like a court case, where they're arguing on someone's behalf why they should be voted in, and they're doing it in front of a group of people to convince them and sway them. And players, you like choose a journalist of their liking to make that case for them. It's really awkward.
That's so weird.
It's really awkward when you're talking about wanting someone to be like an unbiased observer, a relatively unbiased observer. Or who knows? Maybe some fans don't want that. Maybe they want someone that's kind of a homer, but whatever. The thing with the NBA, what I would say is that I don't think it was ever collectively bargained as like media having a vote. It was collectively bargained that the results of the awards would play a role in contract sweeteners and stuff like that. So it was more like if you're on the All-NBA team, you'll become eligible for X, Y, and Z. But obviously, as you mentioned, the media votes on a lot of those things. And so it ends up being something where the media has a say in it, which that's the part that's uncomfortable. And that is part of why I don't really have an overwhelming interest to vote on things. Now, it's also awkward because when I see the way that certain people vote, knowing how much basketball I watch and how intent I am on really studying the stuff and watching the stuff and talking to people and talking to people around the league, I think I feel more of an obligation to do my homework on it than some people do. And I also have a job where I'm blessed to not have to focus on just one team. I get to watch the whole league. And I'm watching all these guys in most cases multiple times a week. So there is a push-pull kind of a, you know, for me where it's like, well, I don't want to be involved in the voting, but at the same time, if you're worried that people are kind of making uninformed votes, and I hopefully it's not most people, but there sometimes you look at votes and you're like, what on earth? Like, why is Andre Drummond, you know, being voted all defensive team or defensive player of the year? When you see votes like that, you'd start to wonder, like, maybe I should vote, because if that's how the votes are going to play out without me there, then maybe I need to counterbalance that. So it's weird, but just generally speaking, I'm really uncomfortable with the fact that, again, no one was seeking to make the media do that, but because the media are the ones that vote on it, it's not great. But also, I'll say this too, we've also seen that the players kind of piss on their votes too, where for All-Star games, they vote for people that don't play. And quite frankly, you know, as much as coaches are voting, like, head coaches aren't generally the ones scouting everything. Their assistants are doing a lot of that stuff. They know the players, they know their reputations, but the reputations are pretty hardened in people's minds anyway. And so I don't really like anything where when you're responsible for kind of focusing on your team, either as a beat writer or as a coach, it doesn't really move me that much. I don't think that's a great idea. I think the people that have to watch everybody, so folks that are covering the whole league as best they can, and I think like advanced scouts that have to watch every team and have to watch a team that they're going to have to play 4 or 5 days from now, a week from now, 2 weeks from now. Like, those should probably be the people. And then maybe some other folks around the league, or maybe you make some emeritus voters that kind of have won before and they've got the ability to watch different teams. But it does make me a little bit uncomfortable the way it's set up. And it's certainly either the reason or a reason that I don't vote myself.
There should be an expert panel of Skip Bayless and the Inside the NBA crew, and they get to decide all the NBA teams just kind of based on how they're feeling that night. I'm wondering while you're talking that there must be a ton of player lobbying of journalists that goes on behind the scenes, right? Or is that not, that's not really how it works out?
Well, no.
Players.
Of course there is. It's one of the few things I like about not being in the locker room, because I think we all have people that we come to enjoy or appreciate. You know, I wouldn't say I'm friends with anybody, but certainly people that you're friendly enough with. But absolutely. And I mean, I don't even necessarily know it's a bad thing, because like, it's, you know, I look at Dwayne Wade. Dwayne Wade, everybody liked covering Dwayne Wade. And I think you see a lot of that on television. He's just a really pleasant person, unusually pleasant for someone that's a star. I've kind of described Carmelo Anthony the same way, but within that, you know, and I don't, who knows, I can only step outside myself so much, but like, I don't generally think I've had those sorts of interactions, but I imagine that anyone that serves as a constant source for you that you kind of trust to be your eyes and ears in a locker room or something like that, that generally speaking, yeah, people are going to be more inclined to kind of, you know, whether it's that, whether it's a coach that you spent time covering. It's really interesting. And honestly, for the book that I'm working on, I've had like 2 or 3 people read what I'm preparing to, you know, to publish as a book, where in my case, you know, I've interviewed 200 some people for this book, but there were some people that made themselves available for weekly calls, an hour every Friday, you know, that I talked to 13, 14 times. So I've talked to them for a total of 15 hours for the book. And it's like, okay, is there a way to make sure that I'm not, you know, you just develop more friendly relationships with certain people. And I know locker rooms work the same way, but you don't want it to color too much of what you're doing. And again, certainly when you're talking about something where it's $30, $40 million on the line for certain people, it just, and I hate it, but it's not a responsibility journalists asked for. It was something that was collectively bargained within the way that those awards were already voted for, but it's not my favorite thing, and I don't really know what would be perfect for it. I do think you probably could develop a panel of people that would do it, but then people would, you know, hone in on those 10, 15, 20, 30 people and then wonder what biases they have. So it's like, it's never perfect. I watch people, you know, tweet and say wild things about Zach Lowe. You know, I've had people come at me for, you know, disagreeing with them on something. And it's like, it's also very funny that, like, the people that are diehard fans of a team or a player think that they're somehow less biased than you are as a writer that doesn't care who wins or loses. But that happens a lot too. And so you go through it. I go through it. You know, it's not a perfect science, but it doesn't seem like a perfect plan to have journalists vote on these things, at least ones that cover teams, and in some cases ones that work for teams, which is difficult too.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned your book, Chris. Let's close by asking you a couple questions about the book, which may be difficult because I know there's only so much you can say right now about the book, but what can you tell the audience about what the book is about, what led you to it, and where things stand as of today?
Sure. Well, let me share as much as I can. I'm done with it. I had a long call with my editor yesterday for about an hour and a half where we went line by line through the probably 45, 50 best anecdotes that I have that aren't in the book right now, and whether we're just going to leave those on the cutting room floor or should I try to work some of them in, which could create their own second book if I wanted to. And he was like, okay, we got to keep like these at least four or five things, including one that I said I wouldn't use when I was on a call on Locker Room. This hilarious story about Anthony Mason and just the way that guy's wired. He's I'll share that one. I don't know if we're running out of time, but if there's enough time, I can share that.
No, I want to hear. Yeah, definitely share that. Yeah,
but all good.
The story, like I said, I told it once on a Locker Room or a Clubhouse call or something, but because I thought it wouldn't end up in the book. Now I'm going to try to shoehorn it in at the very end, maybe in the epilogue. But Anthony Mason, I think in 1992, he'd been on the Knicks for, you know, one season. And if you know these summer camps that, you know, teams have where they, you know, 9 to 12-year-olds come out for a couple hours. And, you know, the teams always try to provide at least one player to go to the camp, sign autographs, to watch, to introduce themselves, you know, just so kids have something that they can, ooh, you know, one of those things for a little kid. And it's never, you know, it's never the Patrick Ewing or the John Starks. It's like a Mason. It's someone that's like sort of secondary, but important enough to where people know who they are. So the Knicks were having their first annual summer camp, and Mason came out. I think they agreed to pay him $1,200 if he was okay with that to come out for the one day for a couple hours. And he said, okay, cool. They sent a limo to pick him up. He gets in the limo, he comes to the facility, he's in the limo and rolls his window down so the kids see him and they go nuts as if he's like a Hollywood celebrity. But then he refuses to get out of the limo. And after like 5, 10, 15 minutes, Ed Tapscott, who was at the time, I think he was the director of administration for the Knicks, but later would become their general manager. He was the one who had been in charge of either the camp or in charge of Mason coming to the camp that day. And he was like, Mace, why are you not getting out of the car? All these kids are waiting for you. And Mace is like, I'm not getting out. He's like, what do you mean you're not getting out? He said, well, two things. One, I need you to make it $2,000 even, not $1,200. And two, I need it in cash and I need it now. And Ed Tapscott's like, what? And keep in mind, this is like the early 1990s. So like, I'm not sure how prevalent ATM machines were at the time. Maybe they were everywhere. But even now, if you were to go to an ATM machine, like, I don't know that you can take out $2,000 in cash.
Yeah.
So Ed Tapscott's like, you're kidding, right? And he's like, I'm dead serious. I'm not getting out of the car until you can tell me that I'll have this thing. So he's like holding him hostage. So he's like, okay, I don't even really know what choice I have because we've got these hundreds of kids just sitting here, like, waiting on you to come inside. So he's like, I'll send, like, one of my assistants to run to the ATM and take out as much cash as they can, but we need you in here. You agreed to this. Like, be professional. And Mace is like, I'll be professional if you can give me the $2,000. So anyway, Mace comes in. Kids go nuts. He's playing with them. In one case, I think he participated in a scrimmage with them, but he's Mace. Like, he doesn't know how to turn it off. As an aside, his son told me that he once played a game up to 11 by ones with him on the day of his son's graduation, graduated from eighth grade, and Mace was on the cusp of losing, and Mace basically knocked his son out cold in a game, just like knocked him out of the air when he's going up for a layup, and then was like very heartless about it. And he, while he was on the ground, like, he picked up the ball and scored one basket on his own to finish the game. It was kind of like loving basketball.
Oh, my God.
Anyway, that's an aside. But Mace ended up knocking out one of the kids at the camp cold by accident. He, like, hit him in the nose. The kid was, like, out, down for the count, like, not responding. And Mace hovers over him to make sure he's okay. The kid comes to. His nose is just gushing blood. His nose is broken. The Knicks, the people that worked for the Knicks that were there were, like, petrified because they thought there was going to be a lawsuit. But the kid wakes up and, you know, sees Anthony Mason hovering over him, has this massive smile, and asks Mason if he can have an autograph. So he autographed his bloody shirt, apparently. Anyway, so that all is over. The camp ends, and Mace takes his money, says thank you. He says, oh, by the way, I'm going to have the limo driver drop me off, but then I need the limo driver to take my mom to the mall. That was what I wanted the extra money for. You know, after that happens, Ed Tapscott is just in disbelief. Ernie Grunfeld, the general manager at the time, gets the invoice for the limo ride, which should have just been a one-way, you know, basically a two-way ride to pick
him
off. It was like three times what it should have been in terms of the invoice and the cost for that. So Grunfeld wants to know what was behind it. And then, you know, Tapscott has to tell him the truth, you know, that Mace decided he was going to take like a joyride for his mom and also build us extra for his appearance at the camp. Grunfeld goes off, and then Mason gets called into Grunfeld's office and has to explain it. And then Mason gets mad at Tapscott for like ratting him out. It's like, so anyway, he was extremely difficult with people. I mean, I spent more time reporting on Anthony Mason than anyone in this book, in part because I feel such a responsibility to get his story right. He's not here to defend himself.
Right.
He has a lot of people, I think, just curious about what his life was like anyway. He's beyond fascinating. Wrote a whole chapter about just him that might actually be the longest chapter in the book, between him and Don Nelson's chapter. But no, I mean, I had such a blast doing it. I mean, I'll probably give second thought to before, you know, whether I ever do this again, just because it's so painstaking. It's 200 interviews. It's taken me 2 years, granted a full-time job as well, but two and a half years to do it. But I, you know, the Knicks fans, and I say this all the time, they deserve to kind of, you know, for a team that I think they hold up in the light that they do with that team, they deserve to kind of have the backstory of what those teams were like. And I, you know, I'm biased, obviously, a little bit, but I really do think that team was completely, completely fascinating. And I'd like to think, like, I'm not Woj, and I think people that read my work know that. I'm still not Woj with regards to, you know, the stories in this book, but I do think there's going to be a ton of stuff in there that, like, people just did not know, including some of the really big moments that, like, changed the history of the team that people just don't know, that aren't out there, that people were sharing for the first time, or they're like, I found out just enough information to where, like, wait, you know that? You're one of, like, three people that's ever been told that. And it's just never, these stories have never seen the light of day. For Mason's chapter in particular, I made it a point to try to talk to about 10, 15, 20 people in his life that weren't just teammates or weren't just people with the Knicks. So it's people that kind of know their origin stories and all the stuff that didn't happen on the court, you know, in the locker room that they know about. So I tried to get to at least a few people like that in every main person's life in the book, but certainly Mason's, and certainly opponents who had a lot of crazy stories too, just about what happened and what went into certain moments with the Heat and with the Pacers. And so I think there's going to be a lot there. Like I said, I'm obviously biased, but I'm hoping that fans feel that way too. And the last thing I ever want is for someone to, you know, people bug me every day, not bug me, but ask me every day, you know, like, when's it done? When will it be out? The last thing I want is for people to salivate over a book and then for it to be a dud. And I really don't think it will be. I really think that it'll shed a lot of new light on a lot of really important things. It'll be out in January. From what I've been told, because my publishers are business people, they want to potentially hold the pre-sale until, wait on the pre-sale until closer to Black Friday, which means another wait, but the book itself is basically done, and I'm really proud of it, and I hope that other people enjoy it once it's out.
That's awesome.
I know. Yeah, I mean, yeah. Obviously, there's going to be a lot in the book, which sounds really fascinating. And you're not going to be able to get into all of it here. Just listening to you as an outsider, someone who was not, you know, a Knicks fan during the '90s, but it felt like there were a couple iterations of that team, and when Anthony Mason left, it was a real I don't even know the story of why he left.
They dealt him for Larry Johnson with Charlotte. Larry Johnson, was trying to get off Larry Johnson's contract, which I think at one point had been the biggest in league history.
But he was playing the same role, right? You know, in the,
Exactly.
So, you know, he seems like a fascinating figure. And the other one is Starks. I mean, the main thing I will always remember about John Starks is the two things: dunking over, was it Pippen in the playoff?
It was all. It was all of them.
All of them. And then, obviously, the three for whatever the game seven shooting.
That was also all of them. It was all of them.
It was very much all or nothing with him all the time.
But did that like weigh on him forever? Is he over it? Yeah, I mean, that's a tough, it's a tough beat to carry.
So, so two things. To your first question, Mason was real hurt when he got traded. Mason was really, he wounded very easily. Like, he obviously had a really rough, tough exterior. I've talked to, you know, Fred Kerber, who told me that, you know, former beat writer, that almost after every game he asked Fred, Mace would ask Fred, like, how'd I look tonight? How'd I play tonight? Like, not in a self-absorbed sort of way, but just kind of like, what did, he really cared what other people thought a lot. And a lot of people are like that. You know, some of the rough, tough stuff is almost like overcompensating for how vulnerable you actually are. And so Mace really cared. You know, it's pretty well documented that Riley suspended him, certainly the one time, but he was suspended a second time the year after, where he almost was left off the playoff roster because he kind of insubordination sort of stuff. And I've had multiple people tell me, and even going back to college, he was basically almost kicked out of school at one point from what I got in my reporting. And everybody kind of kept saying the same thing, where like, you can't kick him off the team. You can't do it because like, we don't know what'll happen if you do that. Like, he just cares so much about the game and about the sport, and like, he'll unravel if you do that. And so it was real rough for him to get shipped out of New York. Some of it probably did have to do with his kind of deteriorating relationship. It wasn't horrible, but it wasn't good with Patrick Ewing, as far as, you know, keep in mind the year he was traded was the year after Don Nelson had essentially handed him the keys to the offense as the point forward. And so Patrick still very much wanted it to be his offense and his team. And all of a sudden, Anthony Mason, who certainly was a good player and a talented player, but nowhere near Ewing's kind of realm, that, you know, there was tension there, and Anthony Mason felt like he should be on the court all the time. You know, he led the league in minutes and was still complaining that he didn't play enough. He went from being sixth man to the minutes leader in the NBA and was still complaining to people that he wasn't playing enough or didn't have a big enough role as the point forward, the starting point forward. So he it absolutely hurt him. There's a lot of detail that I have about the trade, and it was such a big trade at the time for Larry Johnson that the Knicks actually went down to Charlotte as a contingent, you know, or you know, as a group to go handle the trade, just because it was such a kind of unprecedented thing to trade, you know, the priciest player in the league. Larry Johnson, I think it was a 12-year, $84 million deal he had. But that was a really big deal to let go of Mason and to get him. To your other question with Starks, yeah, it stuck with him for a while. I not to like current day, but it got to a point where Starks at one point sat and watched a replay of game seven the next year because he was slumping so terribly and thought that he had to watch it as a way to kind of exorcise those demons. You know, like an exorcism, basically. So it was really
like Anderson syndrome. Yeah.
He basically couldn't sleep for a few. I mean, that was kind of the thought as to why he played so poorly in game seven to begin with, is that he was kind of traumatized by the way game six ended, where he had a chance to win the whole thing. You know, Olajuwon got a fingertip, maybe a fingernail on the, you know, what would have been potentially the game-winning shot to win game six and win the finals for the Knicks. And when that played out the way it did, he could not sleep and could not get that play out of his head from replaying in his head. And he said, you know, at least at the time, that like his kids would come up to him and ask him stuff and like he wouldn't hear them. Like, he zoned out so badly thinking about the way that series played out, that he was a wreck. And, you know, I do think he did get over it eventually. But, yeah, I mean, he was a guy that just – and there's a lot of detail on this in the book. He just was, like, so strong-willed and so strong-minded to where – if he had his heart set on something, his mind set on something, he really felt like he only needed one shot to go down to fix it. And dating back to like his childhood, he operated that way where it was so all or nothing with him. And it obviously had times where it worked and was a good thing. And, you know, and I think to Riley's credit point, you know, to his defense, whatever you would call it. And I certainly kind of, you know, lay out a whole lot of critiques about Pat Riley during those years. But, you know, I think what's lost in the, and I think Matthew and I've talked about this before on another podcast, John Starks had shot very, very well in that finals. He had a really horrible game one where he shot 3 for 18, basically exactly the same as what he did in game seven. But then in games 2 to 6, he shot 50% and he shot 45% from three for games 2 to 6. And not just that, but he had double digit fourth quarters in game 4, game 5, and game 6. So even if he started poorly, there was enough there to suggest that, like, you got to leave him in for the end because that might be the time that he goes off, including almost winning game 6. So I understand why Riley stuck with him, but everybody, and even in the book I mentioned, Ed Tapscott told me that Red Holzman was sitting next to him for game 7. He's like, Red, I don't remember Red ever issuing a single critique of Pat Riley except during that game 7 where he kind of looked over at me and he said, don't you think maybe this is the time we should consider playing Rolando Blackman with how bad Starks is playing, maybe even just to give him a breather? And it was the one and only time that, that Red ever kind of even questioned what Riley's doing. Obviously not to Riley's face, but just even sitting in the crowd that game, like, it was such a strong thought. I've talked to players from the Rockets that were dreading the idea that Rolando Blackman might come in, because Rolando Blackman had ripped the Rockets limb from limb when he was a Dallas Maverick. You know, if you look at his splits for his career, he averaged more points against the Rockets than any other team in the league. So it really ate away at him. You know, it ate away at Starks for a while. Riley's called it the biggest mistake he's ever made in his career, although he's also said that, you know, he would have never dreamed of taking out John because John had done so much in that series. So, you know, people's opinions change, their feelings change. Sometimes they say stuff, I think, for dramatic effect, but that certainly was a moment that, you know, that I think everybody will remember. But what's so interesting about it to me is kind of the juxtaposition between Starks and Charles Smith, and the idea that Charles Smith has this moment, you know, that lives in infamy, and so does John Starks. But I think there were enough good moments around John Starks to where fans don't remember that by itself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, fans love John Starks. And, you know, almost like the theater mask that they have where there's the happy side and the sad side. Like, you've got the dunk Starks, but you've also got the 2 for 18. It's just a big ass sad face with the Charles Smith thing. And I have a little bit in the book too, just about how even if he's let that moment go, I'm not sure if he ever has, Charles Smith. And certainly fans have not. And, you know, God bless him, someone that, you know, still goes to work in New York. And I remember the day I called him to try to interview him, he declined. But when I tried to interview him, I could hear the subway doors closing behind him. So he's very much in the city and people, you know, but I know people still let him have it and let him hear it about that moment. And it's like the human part of me feels for him from that standpoint.
Yeah, that's very sad. And I feel that probably what also works against Starks, which is really to his credit, that offseason the Knicks played game sevens against Chicago and Indiana before Houston. And Starks had big second halves or big moments in those second halves. I imagine Riley was waiting on that. But I remember watching that game, and you were completely torn between Starks doesn't have it. And Starks had nights where he did not have it. But he was also the guy that, like, they're not there without him. They're literally not there without him. And he had multiple big games and big spots. So, but, yeah, I can't go to bed tonight thinking about Orlando Blackman.
Someone told me, I think it was Curtis Bunn, who covered the team back then. He said, you know, look back at those games. Look at the numbers even. You don't even have to watch the games. Somebody had to step up for them. And obviously, normally, you would say Patrick Ewing does it. Patrick was really brutal in that series. I mean, offensively, at least. I have a line in my my book about, I think he maybe shot 39% in game one, but then it was like 39, 37, and then like, you know, 31 and 29% for like the first four games. He had a good game five, I remember.
The OJ game.
Yeah.
The game nobody saw.
He played. That's the most Ewing thing. Yeah, like, the
game nobody saw. But then brutal in the other five or six games. Now, that he did, I think he blocked it. NBA Finals record number of shots. But he was really rough on offense, and because of it, you couldn't go to him. And it's really interesting too, you know, to end that game six, that Patrick has kind of complained over the years, playfully, because he and Starks are still on great terms, but you know, Starks ran a pick and roll with Patrick to end game six. And to some extent, because they ran a pick and roll instead of just letting Starks ISO, that might have been what killed the play, because it brought Hakeem Olajuwon in to switch and just get enough of a hand on the ball to block the shot. Whereas if they just run it as an ISO, you know, maybe Starks gets a one-on-one. But anyway, you know, what was really fascinating about that, Starks could have passed the ball to Patrick on that play. He was pretty open. I go back and forth about whether there was enough time for him to make the pass there. But I've had a lot of people tell me that Starks was a pretty horrendous bounce passer, particularly to Patrick. He just wasn't very good at it. Sometimes Riley would yell at him in practice about it. But also, if you watch the 2 or 3 minutes that precede that game-ending play on game six, Starks had tried to get the ball to Patrick and it got stolen. So, like, there's so many things that go in everybody's mind. But Patrick, for years, has brought up that play because, remember, he was an assistant under Jeff Van Gundy in Houston. And if you've ever been to Houston as a reporter, when you walk in, they've got a huge, I don't know if you'd call it a mural or just kind of like one of those big fat head stickers sort of thing, where it's like the whole length of the wall, a picture of Hakeem Olajuwon blocking that Starks jumper in game six. And Ewing was like, he tells Starks also, he's like, man, I'm still not over the fact that you didn't pass me the ball there. I was wide open. So I get it from both sides, but Patrick was not overly effective in that series. Probably he really had two guys, I think, that you have to hands down say were better centers than he was in that era. I think you have to say that certainly Olajuwon was probably the best center in that era. And I think David Robinson, you can probably pretty safely say too, he struggled against him as well.
How much did he have knee problems? Did he have physical by that point? I don't even know if that's true. But didn't he have some kind of leg problems that kind of slowed him down? And then
absolutely.
Patrick Ewing?
Yeah, I mean, I've had guys that told me, I've had some guys tell me, man, like Riley's the reason his knees were bad. I've had other people tell me, man, his knees were bad before he ever got to the NBA. They were already starting to go a little bit. You look back at old pictures of him, he was wearing those knee pads.
Yeah, it was.
You know, it was like a second, third-year guy. I mean, he was – and I've had some guys tell me that just the Knicks generally, not a coach or anything specific, but one guy told me, like, I started developing knee problems right as I left the Knicks because the court we practiced on was shitty. You know, that they were practicing on a rock-hard court. And if you look back on it, like, it sounds kind of, like, crazy and just coincidental, but – the Knicks under Hubie Brown, I have one chapter in the book on the 80s years that led up to Riley and Patrick Ewing being together. And the Knicks set an NBA record for most games lost to injury in 1985. And then they broke that record in 1986. And so, you know, people saying, I think it was at USALA College. I'm not sure how you pronounce it, but they were saying the court we practiced on every day was just crappy. And it probably did kind of ruin some guys' careers. And that would have been around the time that Patrick was there, like just getting there and whether he had problems pre-existing. Riley certainly would not have helped with those problems. There certainly was no load management. And Doc Rivers told me when I talked to him for the book, he was great. He said that as he got traded to the Knicks, because he was still in Los Angeles, he came over in that Charles Smith deal from the Clippers. He said, I remember I was working out in the off seasons with Magic and I think James Worthy. And he said that each one of those guys told him, Riley's going to kill your career. It might be worth it because you'll win and you haven't won a title yet, but make no mistake about it. Like Riley is so intense. It's going to kill your career. It's going to kill your knees. It's going to kill your career. And Doc was someone that had already had a lot of injury problems before he got to the Knicks. And then when he got to the Knicks, they did get really close to winning a title, but they almost did it without Doc because Doc tore his ACL. The same night Patrick Ewing became the all-time leading scorer of the Knicks, Doc tore his ACL. So I think there was some truth to that. Like it wasn't an era where guys were concerned about, guys were as concerned about the idea of minutes restrictions or anything else. It was just you got it out. And quite frankly, and I get into real detail in this on the book, I think it was part of the reason that Charles Smith was kind of remembered the way he was. I think he had teammates of his that thought that he was kind of playing up how hurt he was or how much he actually was hurt, because everybody else played through everything else. You know, Oakley would have a broken hand, you know, have a broken toe, you know, dislocated toe, and was playing through it. And then there was Charles Smith, who had a knee clean out in the off season, and then 2-3 months into the season is saying he needs another knee clean out. And they're looking at him like he's crazy when he's someone that just has chronic knee problems. And that didn't resonate with guys that were playing through everything. So I think that people were harder on him than they should have been and needed to be. And I get into a lot of detail about that as well.
This is fascinating. I am so excited for when this book is going to come out. I will have you on again any hour, because I'll give you Olajuwon is better than Ewing, but I am happy to fight back on David Robinson. It's one of my the windmills that I have been fighting my whole life.
I think it's debatable. It's certainly debatable. I've got my chapter on Ewing. It doesn't quite start with the debate on that, but it kind of goes through the list. I'll give you that it was really close, and I think that for most people, Robinson's title probably puts him over the top. But prior to that, their careers were real similar to where they were basically in – you know, with their franchises as the lone guy. And they were very, very parallel up to that point, I think. I'll give you that.
If the Knicks had gotten Tim Duncan instead of John Wallace, I guarantee you Patrick Ewing would be more highly regarded. Jonah, just to close with a Celtic-Nick 90s connection, Don Nelson was not there very long at all, but it was a very interesting 50-something games, I think, when he was there. And my favorite memory of the Don Nelson season, I might have mentioned this before in front of you, Chris. The Knicks played a game in Boston that year, and Dana Barros was close to or had set the record at the time for the most consecutive games with a three-pointer. And the Knicks played a game in Boston, and in the last, maybe there's about 8 seconds left, not even maybe 8 seconds, the game is over. The Knicks have won. There's no contest. ML Carr calls timeout for Boston to draw up a play so Barros, who had not hit a three to that point, can try to make one. Don Nelson sticks Mason on Barros because the Knicks are so annoyed that ML Carr called timeout just to do this. Barros cannot even get the shot off. The game ends. ML Carr picks up the basketball and throws it at Don Nelson's head because he is so annoyed. So it's a long forgotten but very.
And the greatest thing about that anecdote, as you say that, is that I'm pretty sure the Knicks players hated Don Nelson more than ML Carr did. Even after that anecdote,
he was lucky that only a basketball was being thrown at him.
You know, I have so many Boston connections there. Dana Barros is from Boston before he played on the Celtics. Okay. Yeah, he's a Boston kid, and ML Carr and Don Nelson obviously. Mm-hmm. Celtics greats. Don Nelson, very innovative coach, obviously did not work out everywhere. I've seen pictures of him recently, and he's kind of got a hippie-ish thing
very
going on.
He's like 80 years old.
He looks very, very happy. Good. May we all grow up to be as happy as Don Nelson.
I'll tell you what, man, that chapter was a doozy. Like, if I had to rank order the seasons as far as, like, I went from 91, 92 to 98, 99. So the first year that Riley was hired, I mentioned that I've got a chapter on the 80s just to talk about how close they were, everything just going up in flames between Ewing and not ever getting Riley. But then I go to 99, that second finals run they made. If I had to rank order the seasons, I would probably say the craziest ones were 94, the year they made the finals. 99, which was the year they fired Grunfeld and that like Dolan started to really first get involved. Mm-hmm. And like Sprewell and Marcus Camby and all the stuff with that. And, you know, Phil Jackson, them courting Phil Jackson while Jeff Van Gundy was already there. But then like a close second with that one would be the Don Nelson season was nuts. Cause I mean, it just, I have that chapter titled right now. And it's called whack-a-mole just because there were so many problems. And every time something would get fixed, I mean, just like there were like 8 things at a time that would pop up. And it just I used to play Oregon Trail, a computer game. There was obviously the really old version that's like, you know, when computers were first invented. But I had like a CD-ROM version that was really cool where you could be the wagon train leader and you got to make decisions about what route you would take and how much food you would give to everybody and whether you'd stop in town to go get, you know, to buy supplies. But if you, for instance, if someone died during the trip and you didn't have a funeral for them, the wagon train morale would like plummet. And if you didn't celebrate the 4th of July, the wagon train would plummet in morale. And I feel like, and they could fire you as the wagon train leader if it happened. And I feel like that's what happened with Don Nelson that season. Is everybody just got real angry and morale was gone. And it was, yeah, they were super ready to get him out of there. Some real horror stories with him. I don't know. I could talk to you guys all day. I hope at some point I'm able to once it's all out.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. We will. So the book is Blood on the Hardwood, The Flagrant History of the 1990s Knicks by Chris Harry. And it comes out in January. So we will look out for that. Chris, thank you so much for being on with us. We will hope to have you again on in the future. But this is a real honor and a pleasure to have you for this time with us. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me, guys. I really appreciate you guys.
It was really awesome. And New Yorkers, stop giving Charles Smith the Bill Buckner treatment. That is my main takeaway from, you know, from this whole discussion. Leave him alone. He deserves better, damn it.
He does.
Yeah.
So wrapping it up, today's guest, Chris Herring. You can find him on Twitter at Herring_NBA. The producer who makes us sound likable is Connor Gillies. Remember that you can follow us on Twitter at Jacobin Sports and email us with any thoughts or questions or suggestions at jackemansports@gmail.com. That is all for episode 17. We will see you all next week. Take care. Be safe. Goodbye.